Seth was a priest. He served for 10 years and 163 days. Then he decided to die. Have you ever questioned whether you were doing the right thing, beginning with this bungled suicide attempt? His book, Faithless, charts the incidents within Seth's ministry that led him to that point. The book is called Faithless. It's been written by Seth Walker. Seth joins me live on the line now. Seth, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Giles. It's a pleasure to be able to talk with you and the listeners.
Think nothing of it. Now, tell me a little bit about then, because this is a book that questions faith, questions why we were here, and also obviously a very, very dark time in your life. Give me a little bit about how you came to go into the priesthood, how you made religion the center point of your life, and then what happened?
I suppose I didn't come to that point of making religion the center point of my life. I was brought up in a fundamentalist Christian home, and faith was just part of life. It was interwoven. And as I grew up, I started to show signs to the people around me in the unconventional church that I was in that I would be in some form of church leadership involving caring for people pastorally. And so it sort of naturally evolved that I would go away and get training to prepare me for that ministry that people said I had the gifts for. And that's how I ended up at theological college. I applied and I got in to do a theology degree to strengthen my faith.
And after theological college, presumably you went straight into a ministry? So tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, I had a 7-month break. My first post was 7 months after I finished theological college, and I went and lived with my parents, who were managing a castle in the middle of nowhere in North Yorkshire. And I wrote a book while I was there, a novel that's never been published, and I hope it never is published, because it's a pretty tragic piece of work from my point of view. But 7 months later, I went to my first parish, and how I got there was a process that began well over a year before. I was doing some work as an intern for an evangelistic association. I kept meeting this same man that ended up becoming a bishop in the church, and he saw in me qualities that he thought would work in Bluebell Common, and so he asked if I would go and look at Bluebell Common, which I did, and We set the work up to begin on January the 1st, 1988.
Bluebell Common, excuse me for my ignorance, is that a place? Is it a parish? Please explain what that is.
Okay. Bluebell Common was a small pit village on the outskirts of a northern city where the pit had shut down, and there was 64% unemployment amongst the adults that were there. And there was quite a high level of deprivation.
It's interesting because you mentioned Bluebell Common. It sounds like it should be some sleepy Sussex sort of countryside village with thatched roofs, etc., and grinning neighbours. Obviously, the reality was somewhat different.
Yeah, it was somewhat different, but there's a Bluebell Common on the outskirts of many towns and cities. The product, Bluebell Common wasn't, but these are the product of 1960s social housing policy. But Bluebell Common had existed to provide housing for miners at a pit that no longer existed.
So you go into this, you go into Bluebell Common. How old were you by this point, by the way?
When I started at Bluebell Common, I was 23 and a half.
Mm. I mean, it does seem to be, there's nothing wrong. If you have faith, you have faith. It doesn't matter. The age isn't really important. But you're dealing, obviously, with a situation and a parish who are maybe a little bit older than you and perhaps a little bit have had more life experience, perhaps. And you mentioned the deprivation. So how do they relate to a young priest coming in?
Right, at that point, I wasn't a priest, I was a lay minister in the Church of England.
Right.
And it was important because relationships with some of the people at Bluebell Common and the outside world, authorities, the statutory organisations that were there had broken down. And at the heart of the issues there was a group of young people, which is why I was recruited as a young person to go and live and work there, to see if we could do some work to repair that breakdown and to establish a small worshipping community there.
What was the... Because obviously, you've studied, you've gone to theological college. What was the actual... your perception of, or your thoughts of what the job would be like as opposed to the reality of it?
I knew it would be difficult. My problem was that in theological terms, I was all about the need for people to be saved from their sins and believe in Jesus. But actually going to Bluebell Common was displaying a different sort of theology, the incarnation. When Jesus came to be amongst us and live amongst us as one of us, it's quite a powerful message. What I didn't realise was I was getting things wrong in thinking I had to go there and save everybody just by dint of being there and living in the same housing as everyone else and sharing the same way of life as everyone else had quite a powerful message in itself.
And I mean, talking about the Bluebell Cottage, again, the name perhaps suggesting an idyllic situation. Did you have any hints that, or any inkling that there would be, because there were some pretty, you served for 10 years and 163 days, as I said in the intro, but there were some pretty extreme circumstances, cults, exorcisms. I mean, this presumably is not your average. I mean, I do not know because I'm not involved in ministering, but cults and exorcisms are not, I would think, happen in your everyday, your everyday priest life.
No, 3.5 years was at Bluebell Common. And the remainder of the time was at two different locations. The first two-thirds of the book took place at Bluebell Common, and then I described my transition on to the next parish and the next parish. And so the weird thing was that it doesn't matter about the socio-economic makeup of the area. A lot of the problems were similar, but they were couched in different ways. So there was domestic abuse. There was mental health issues. There were financial issues. It doesn't matter where you go, those issues are the same. We all suffer from the same pains, the same hurts, the same griefs, and the same losses. It's just that sometimes some people, maybe if they're younger themselves and have been at the mercy of difficult situations, don't have a good way of expressing it.
I mean, it's interesting that you dealt, had to deal with a cult leader as well, because especially in times of hardship and of deprivation, people can be looking for a way out and reject the norms, quote unquote. And you can get people turning to some pretty extreme, what they think are solutions. So what was, as a man of faith, how do you deal with people who are being attracted to cults or extremism or anything like that?
It's a very difficult circumstance. I describe my encounter with someone called Cecil, and Cecil had a vulnerability and was suffering from all kinds of anxiety, and his life was ruled by obsessive compulsive disorder, and he had that vulnerability, and cults have a way of sniffing out people's vulnerabilities and as a way in for them to begin to get control and get them as a member and get them productive. And that happened to this character called Cecil, and it was working out what his issue was and being able to meet him at his point of need which broke the hold of the cult on him. As a child, I'd suffered from obsessive compulsive disorder, didn't even know what it was, and I broke its power myself because I got so angry at it, but it controlled my life for a good 2 years, and it was when I realised that was what was happening with Cecil, then that was able to help him in his point of need. But how we got to that conversation was, I felt compelled to go and see him, and I was banging on his door. I knew someone was in the house because I could see light on in there, wasn't coming to the door, eventually came to the door. He was clearly upset. The house smelt of bleach. I'd seen sores on him before, and it just clicked. And we had this conversation, and he said to me, at the point of me knocking on the door, and I'd felt compelled to go there, I wanted to go home. I had shopping that I'd got to unpack, frozen shopping. But I just felt compelled to go and see him. He told me that at the point I was knocking at the door, he was in the kitchen trying to select the right knife to end his life. So it was good that I was there at that time.
The book also deals with you performing exorcisms in haunted houses. This is presumably an unusual situation, and not only that, that, you know, it brings the whole quote unquote spirit world, etc. Are you adequately prepared to go in to do this? Even though you've been in the situation for a while now.
Right. The incident where I blessed the house and where people had felt a presence, and it's a really interesting chapter, and where there were the classic signs that you often have in a house where there is a presence and there wasn't at the end of it. I'm still sceptical about it, but that whole thing happened. I was a curate. I was a priest, but a curate. I was in a training parish. My boss was on holiday. It wasn't on our parish. It was a neighbouring parish. Neighbouring parish priest was on holiday, which is why they rang me up. And the people were so concerned and frightened that something was happening, I thought I'd go around and just take it from there. And I did what I always do, is I look at their video collection. If I get the chance, accidentally knock the eject button on the video just to see what's coming out. Look at the bookshelf to see if this is an area they've been fascinated, or maybe they've been scaring themselves. But in this particular case, it was just a usual middle-aged family with an Alsatian dog. The dog wouldn't go upstairs. They heard all kinds of noises and felt presence in the house. As a result of blessing the house, the dog wouldn't go upstairs. I was upstairs praying in a room, and I had a physical thing happen to me where I felt as if I had a real bad spasm across my chest, and it sent me to, I sit down on the bed in the bedroom where I was saying a prayer, and before I could sort of make sense of what was happening, the dog came bounding upstairs, and for the first time in ages went into that room. When I went down and started talking with the family over a cup of tea, it wasn't a massive dramatic thing for the family. I prayed around the house on my own because I didn't want to increase the sense of drama. You want to take that sense of drama out of it. You want to increase when a pan's boiling over. You want to turn the heat right down. They told me that the wife's mother was staying there. Living with them, and she died in that room. And then when I did follow-up visit a while later, the dog was making that room its home in the afternoon sun, going and lying on the bed in the sunshine.
It's an interesting...
So something happened there, but I can't explain. I'm still sceptical about it. Yeah. I don't believe in that realm anymore. Something did occur. I haven't got an explanation for it, but that doesn't leave me just to say, right, that's supernatural.
I just think it's fascinating, the fact that you check the video recorders in the bookshelves before you go in. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, that's a really
people
interesting...
People set the tone in their own house. I set the tone, and my wife sets the tone in our house for our family. I'm sure you do the same thing. I'm sure that the music you listen to, you sound like you're of a similar vintage to me.
It's a good way of putting it, but yes, I like that, yes.
Maybe post-punk new wave.
Oh, yeah,
sort of
exactly. Blimey, you've been doing it.
Quality music. We set the tone in our houses, what we listen to, what we read, and what we watch. And that can often determine how a house feels and what happens, which is why I used to do that if people had a concern in that area. And never over-dramatise it. Any drama that ever came out of a situation, and the last thing you wanted to do was to bring drama and showmanship.
And of course, then there's the everyday, there's the births, marriages, and deaths that every parish has. And I suppose the one thing that we look at, and you minister, people turn to you at times of joy, at times of trouble. But who do you turn to? And you can't just say, I'm sorry, it's 5 o'clock, it's Friday, I'm not working anymore. So these acts are building up. And, you know, at that period of time, because you are, you know, you are the priest, you are supposed to be invulnerable, cast iron, everything bounces off you, but it's not.
No. The problem I've got is this, that I have no issue with the church at all. They were fantastic. They had a system called Episcopal Review, and so I had support around me, but also I was getting increasingly ill. I'd lost my faith, and it had started at theological college when I was studying the Bible. I then started to doubt the Bible as the Word of God, and slowly but surely over this period of 10 years, I unraveled. And like most people that aren't doing so well, rather than asking for help, they keep it to themselves. And that's the one big message I've got from this book is, if you feel yourself in that circumstance or situation, you need to take charge and tell someone. I address this in the later chapter of my book and speak how I've journeyed from a situation where I attempted to take my own life to a real secure position of health and being able to minister to people now, not as a priest, but I do work with people and teams of people and advise organizations where teams aren't working, etc. It's the same skill sets I have now as I had before, and I often found when I'm going there, I can spot the signs of where people are struggling but aren't talking about it as a result of it. If you are having issues, reach out, just do a bit of Google. If you're a young person, go to kooth.com. Go online, get some resources, reach out to someone. Don't try and carry it yourself, because one day, little by little, little pebble by little pebble, the load piles up, and one day you've got a tower of rock on your back that might fall down on you. So get some help and talk.
Isolation is the killer, isn't it? That's the thing. If you isolate, you are in big trouble.
Yeah. And that's what the illness did for me. It put a wall between me and people. There were times when I felt like I was in a room, but behind a plate glass window. I was just so alone, and I couldn't communicate. I was locked in myself. I couldn't communicate. I felt so bad about myself. I couldn't communicate how wretched I felt to people. And all the time, I had the painted-on smile, and I was carrying on doing the things that I thought I needed to do. And in the last year or so of my ministry, I didn't have any faith. I was ministering from that point, and I was feeling like I was a hypocrite, and I had no way out at all. And I should have reached out earlier.
I mean, people say, you know, and a lot of people who have attempted suicide and thankfully haven't gone through with it, but they say, I felt I was living double life. I felt that, you know, nobody could see the real me. Now, that's for the layperson. But for a man of, you know, for a priest to be the man who is the others turn to, a loss of faith must be devastating.
It is. And for me, my worry was added to because I'd come from this background of Christianity. And what I didn't realise was I'd led my life up to that point. Everything I did, I was worried about what other people thought about what I was doing and saying. I was worried about my actions, how they would look, how people would perceive me. And as my children know now, when I'm dad dancing, I'm not worried about that anymore.
Thankfully, your attempt to take your life didn't succeed, and we're having this conversation, and it's a great conversation to have for anybody who is in trouble out there. How did you, because obviously all the walls come crashing down, you have to build yourself back up. How did you go about it, Seth?
A long, slow process, and it's a process that continues today. And I do describe it in the book. I've got someone around me now who points things out to me if I'm starting to drift. I describe it in the book that I am quite portly. I have some timber on my frame, but I also like to run over the moors, and I like to mountain bike ride. And some of the running that I do is totally off piste, off path, with map and compass, not GPS. What's the point? So map and compass. And if you set a bearing on the compass and run to it to get to a point, that point might be a mile away, but you select items between you and that point that you call a handrail, and you run towards it. But if I've been a couple of degrees off on my compass bearing, if the mist is down, after a mile, I'm quite away from where I should be. After 2 miles, I'm a long, long way from where I should be. And if in our life we don't stop, evaluate where we are, our actions, how we're thinking about ourselves and those around us, before you know it, you can be a long way from where you need to be. So when I drive to a client at least once a week, I have a conversation with myself. I call it the sit rep, the situation report. Weigh up exactly what's happening, what do we need to change to move forward, and what are the great things that we can celebrate. And I think it's important to have those conversations. I also have had people that I can talk to professionally, and that is a really important, because your friends are great, but they're not always equipped to know how to unlock things in you that need unlocking.
The book is called Faithless. It's by Seth Walker, who we're talking to today. Seth, if people want to find out more about you and, you know, your incredible story, where can they go? Is there a website? Is there a social media?
I am at Faithless Seth on Twitter. And that's it for social media for me. But the book does paint as full a picture as possible, and I'm open for people contacting me through Twitter if they want to talk. Please buy the book, because I've got a dream of semi-retired. Well, I'm semi-retired now, but retiring next September. And I have two works in progress that I'm writing now. My dream is to be able to stop full-time working with, I bet I don't, but that's my aim. But I want to complete the next two books. And for that to happen, I need a little bit of money. So listeners, if you are at all interested, you can get it online from WH Smith's, Waterstones, or Amazon.
And you can download it. You can download it from our own virtual bookstore, Seth. So there's a quick link as well.
Brilliant.
You describe your day-to-day life now, though. It's good. You know, you have communion with I suppose, the world. And, you know, is it that sort of the ability to go, you know, running in the hills free, and then calling to the deer as well, I believe, and you've got a wife and kids and the dad dancing, etc. Are those little things that have restored a faith?
Yes, having love that you share is really important, and being isolated is probably the worst thing that you can do. So you do need to reach out if you're in a situation and are feeling isolated. But for me, my sense of, I say in the book that if I want to know what it is to be connected to the eternal, I can look in the face of my children and I can see something of me that will live on. If I want to be connected to something bigger than myself, I can go over the moors and I can listen to the murmuring of a moorland stream that's been there thousands of years since the last ice age and will continue to be there. We're part of an absolutely fantastic world. It's awesome. The deer calling was brilliant. The first lockdown was awful for everyone, but good things come out of it. I always say that even in the worst of situations, there's some good things that you can take from them. And in our hours exercise, we used to walk across the valley to a quarry at the side of a hill, and we saw a deer. So from an online retailer, I ordered a deer call. We used to walk across. And initially, I was full dad mode doing the deer calls, and I realized, so I gave the deer call to my boy, oldest, the video cameras, phone to my youngest. They called the deer, they videoed the deer, and I watched. And we must have encountered the same deer about 5 or 6 times during that first lockdown. It's absolutely amazing. And we still do our weekly walks. We haven't seen a deer this winter yet, but we're getting to the time of year when they start to move around, particularly as we move closer to April and May, and I'm sure that we'll see them again.
The book is called Faithless. It's by Seth Walker, who we've been speaking to today. Seth, thank you so much for talking to me. It's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege.
Thank you, Giles. It really is appreciated. And thank you to the listeners.